From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear shorter interviews from the archives with the authors JoJo Moyes and Heath Hartage Lee. The first interview is with JoJo Moyes about her novel One Plus One. JoJo Moyes is a novelist and journalist. Her books include the bestsellers Me Before You, After You, and Still Me, The Girl You Left Behind, and a short story collection, Paris for One, and other stories. Her novels have been translated into 46 languages, have hit the number one spot in 12 countries, and have sold over 38 million copies worldwide. Me Before You has now sold over 14 million copies worldwide and was adapted into a major film. JoJo lives in Essex, England. When I spoke to JoJo Moyes, we discussed her novel One Plus One, published by Penguin. Here's the publisher's summary. Suppose your life sucks a lot. Your husband has done a vanishing act, your teenage stepson is being bullied, and your math whiz daughter has a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity that you can't afford to pay for. That's Jess's life in a nutshell, until an unexpected knight in shining armor offers to rescue them. Only Jess's knight turns out to be Geeky Ed, the obnoxious tech millionaire whose vacation home she happens to clean. But Ed has big problems of his own, and driving the dysfunctional family to the math Olympiad feels like his first unselfish act in ages, maybe ever. When I spoke with JoJo Moyes, I began by asking her how she came to write a road novel, which One Plus One definitely is, and if the road novel is a favorite form for her.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm more a fan of the road movie. You know, I think Thelma and Louise started it off for me. I just was such a lover of that film, and Little Miss Sunshine as well. But yeah, on the road, all those story quirks that basically push people into close confines for a long period of time, as a novelist, that really appealed to me. And also, I just wanted to write something kind of light because I'd just written a really heavy, epic love story, you know, set in World War One. So I tend to want to do the complete opposite.
Yeah. So you knew right from the start that you were going into a road novel when you wrote this?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay, because I didn't know that's where you were going. It's funny because the very beginning of the book doesn't start out with them all in the car, and so it was fun to get there and fun to have that. It was lighter than your last book, absolutely, and fun to read. I loved all your characters. I loved Tansy, and I wondered how are you at math, and did you have to do a lot of research to be able to give her her mathematic vocabulary?
Yes, I did. I am hopeless at maths. I am just the least numerate person you've ever spoken to. But it was really important to me to have a kind of, I wanted a girl to be good at maths rather than a boy. I wanted her to maybe be out of the normal mold because I think, you know, we're so used to thinking that girls don't do maths. And my husband is an engineer by normal, you know, training. And he's really good at math, so I'm afraid I used to kind of pull up math problems and get him to translate it into a language that Tansy might actually use, because I couldn't have done it myself. So we have, you know, math problems in sock drawers and math problems and things like that.
Yeah, it was wonderful. I thought you did a really good job of making her sound very believably mathematically intelligent without adding so much math that it would lose your readers. I wondered if you that know, was a challenge.
Yeah, that was a fine balance. But it was interesting. I had some friends who were violinists. They were two concert violinists. Mm. And when I spoke to them, I quickly realized that they interpreted the whole world through what they heard. And I was a very visual person. My parents were artists. So I realized that everything I do, when I write, I have to see it in pictures before I start. And I suddenly thought, well, Tansy would see the world in numbers. Mm-hmm. You know, she doesn't look at a tree and see a tree. She sees angles. She sees the number of leaves. She sees, you know, the square root of something. So that was the challenge, to try and interpret the world through her eyes and see. I did a lot of research on maths prodigies. Luckily for me, there was a documentary series that was made in the UK following a group of these children, and most of them were on the Asperger's or autism scale, but I didn't want her to be on that. Mm-hmm. But it was so useful in looking at how they really did see the world through numbers and just loved them. They loved losing themselves in these kind of very logical, very abstract worlds.
Yeah, it was. I loved her counting the telephone. I think it was telephone poles as they're driving down the road. You know, she measures the amount of time that's passed in these telephone. Is it telephone poles?
Well, but you know what? That was what I used to do. Even though I'm not numerate, every weekend when I was a child, we used to drive to my grandmother's house. And, you know, this is way back in the days before computer games or even very good radio. So I just used to lie on the back seat counting lampposts. And now when I tell people that, they give me that look that you reserve for people who are kind of crazy. But that was how I killed the journey time.
That's great. Let's see. The book, 1+1, is written from the points of view of four people, a single mother and the two children that she's raising and the man that she meets. So I wondered how difficult was it for you to know who would relay each part of the story? Did you have very many false starts where you had to kind of go back and, okay, this is somebody else's voice, in fact?
Yes, I do. But I'm actually a great planner. I find that novelists tend to divide it pretty cleanly into those that can freeform and just kind of see where the page leads them and those who have to plan the story structure out quite carefully. And I am of the latter variety. So I kind of knew who was going to tell the reader what at any point. And, you know, there are a couple of twists in there that I had to plan for. So I have to say, I know that the, I think they call it multiple first-person narrative, I think in England we call it a Marmite decision. So it's one of these things that you either love or either hate. And luckily, I think it works. But I love writing like that because the joy of sort of slipping into somebody else's voice and, you know, seeing the world through their eyes, even with all their misconceptions and, you know, misunderstandings of a situation is really interesting. And sometimes, you know, it can give the reader a lot of clarity. So we work out that Jess and Ed are getting close, not because we see into their thoughts, but because Nikki or Tansy can see that Mum is putting on extra makeup or, you know, she touches his hand more often than she did. And so I think for a reader, it's sometimes more interesting to see it through somebody else's eyes.
Absolutely. Yeah, I loved it. And I do love that kind of book. I think part of what I love is when the multiple points of view, they come and then they return. It's not like you're going to say goodbye to this person just because you're moving on to the next. You know they're going to be back.
Yeah, I agree. I love books like that. I think, was it The Poisonwood Bible did something similar many years ago? And I found that book devastating, but so much more powerful through being seen through the eyes of different characters.
Right, right. And she had a disabled character, a sort of mentally different character, I'll say, who was one of the... Anyway, yeah. So Jess is a single mom with no savings. She's doing the best she can. She's working multiple jobs trying to raise two children. Do you mind if I read a quick quote from the book?
Sure.
Jess couldn't help thinking that people who thought money was a detail were the kind who had never had to really worry about it. I loved that line, and I loved Jess's character. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about writing Jess's character and also about the task of writing a character who, in a sense, sort of represents a very large, underserved group of people. I wondered if that was ever intimidating.
Well, no. If anything, it made me more determined because I feel like there's a huge class of people who just don't get written about very much unless it's in terms of them being a problem. Mm. And, you know, I look around me and I see, you know, heroic parents, single parents, just fighting to keep food on the table, fighting to bring their kids up well in the face of all sorts of temptations. And I wanted to write a book where you had a family who were perhaps not necessarily conventional, but who were not a problem. You know, they are not the problem in this book. They are the people who are trying to get through. And what happens if, you know, you're a natural optimist, as Jess does, you're hardworking, you tell your kids that whatever happens, if you work hard enough and if you do the right thing, good things will happen. And what happens if that just doesn't happen? Because, you know, I look around me and I see life chances for people like me. When I was young, I was able to buy my own property when I was quite young just because I worked really hard. And my own daughter will not be able to do that without my help. Mm-hmm. And so you think, well, what happens, you know, when those sorts of hope and aspirations are stripped away? But mostly I really wanted to write a mother who was a positive character, because in fiction, mums get a really raw deal. You know, in most fairy tales, they're just killed off. You know,
right.
Even Harry Potter kills off the mother. In great literature, they're often either bossy and domineering and kind of cloth-eared, like Mrs. Bennet in Pride and Prejudice, or, you know, even a book that I loved recently, The Goldfinch. What happens to the mother? She's killed off. So I just wanted to write a really positive relationship between a mum and her kids, because that's also what I see around me. You know, when my kids turned teenagers, I was braced for, you know, World War III to start, and it just didn't. And I figured that actually teenagers are kind of quite interesting, and you don't have to be the difficult mum, and they don't have to be the difficult kids if you can just love each other and listen to each other.
Yeah. The other thing that you did, which I really appreciated, was there's a point in the book, I won't give anything away, but there's almost maybe a stepmother type of character who might be on the fringes of this storyline.
Yeah.
And you do not make her a horrible person, and I really appreciated that, because she's just a victim of her own circumstance.
Exactly. And, you know, most people are just trying to do the right thing. You know, stepmothers, gosh, if mothers get a raw deal in literature, stepmothers get a worse one. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've had a stepmother, and she just tried to do the right thing. Most people do. And so, no, I, you know, it's really easy to write villains into your books. And actually, the reality tends to be far more nuanced and complex than that. And even if people do stupid, horrible things, they're often doing them with the best of intentions or just getting stuff wrong. So I just tried to make my characters a little more complex than that. And, yeah, I didn't want her to be a baddie. You know, I didn't want their dad to be a baddie either. He's just a man who makes bad decisions.
Right. Right. I think that there's a lot of that in this book, with people spontaneously making a bad choice that they have to pay for later. But all right. So here's another aspect of Jess and her financial situation, her life situation. She won't do the things that everyone expects a single parent to do. She has certain rules. She will not claim benefits. She will not smoke. She will not live in council housing. She will not feed her kids McDonald's. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit about the stereotypes of being poor and about your decision to give her these rules that she lives by, which I suspect is sort of similar to why you wanted her to be an optimist and a joyful mother despite her circumstances.
Well, exactly. Well, in the UK, single mom has become kind of a byword for a sort of feckless woman who wants to have an easy life on benefits and, you know, just spends her time spending money on, you know, and just basically reaping all the hard work that everybody else does. And that, again, is just not what I see around me. I know plenty of single mothers, many of whom are kind of struggling to get by, and, you know, single fathers too, I hasten to add. But it's just always more complex than that, and I don't want to give into the stereotypes. And also, there was a really interesting thing I watched with Meryl Streep talking about Emma Thompson, you know, the actress, recently, where Meryl Streep said of Emma Thompson that whenever she takes on a project, she asks herself, will it do good, or at least will it not do bad? And I think that's such an interesting question. And so in my fiction, especially when it relates to writing about girls and women, I ask myself that question. It's just, you know, am I going to perpetuate a stereotype? Am I going to encourage the belief that spending money is the way to happiness? Am I going to, you know, write something that makes... I try and put my daughter into this book and say, how is she going to... what message is she going to take from this book? And I just try to make it a positive one, which is, you know, it's not about how you look, it's about what you do. And it's not, you know, the single mum is definitely not going to be your enemy, and nor is the, you know, the guy up the road who might look like a criminal. It's just look beyond it. Try and not to judge people, I guess.
Right.
Message. Sorry, that sounds very preachy.
No. I asked the question. I thought that was that was an aspect of the book that I really liked, that she had these rules. And anyway, I thought it was great. Let's talk a little bit about Ed. Ed Nichols is a character in the book, and he's the only narrative viewpoint who's not part of this family. And okay, so his first interaction with Jess is a bit prickly. They're both having problems. Neither of them's in the mood to deal with a difficult stranger. And it made me wonder when I was reading this. You mentioned Elizabeth Bennet. You know, I'm thinking of Elizabeth Bennet and Mr. Darcy and all these famous couples. Why do you think we're more engaged as readers if two characters dislike each other before they eventually start to like each other?
Well, you know, I think the hardest thing if you're writing a love story is not what brings your characters together, but what actually keeps them apart. Mm. So, you know, the great joy of reading Pride and Prejudice, for example, is the fact that circumstances and pride and, you know, her family's behavior keep pushing Mr. Darcy and Elizabeth Bennet apart. So the reader just desperately wants them to get together. And I've learned that, you know, it's pretty hard to keep people apart in the modern day because there are no barriers to people being together these days. You know, we have the age of instant communication, we have the booty call, we have, you know, a moral climate that is far less uptight than it was kind of 30 years ago. So there is, you know, you meet a guy on a subway, there is nothing to stop you going home with him. Well, you know, if you're that way inclined. So the hardest thing for a novelist is then, okay, what is going to separate these people? And, you know, in the case of Me Before You, it was the fact that the man was actually in a wheelchair and not able to be physically the person that you know, you might expect from a romantic hero. And in this case, it's the fact that there is an act that happens in the book almost before they meet properly, which keeps Jess at a distance from Mr. Nichols, as she calls him. I mean, you know, her decision to call him Mr. Nichols rather than Ed is pretty telling because she's trying to keep him at arm's length. Mm. But it's also about their differing backgrounds, about the kind of mutual distrust. It's really hard keeping people apart these days. I have to get ever more inventive. I'm going to have to stick them on different planets.
Okay, great. I'm wondering, so my radio show is for writers as well as readers, and I wonder if you have any advice for writers about tackling serious subjects but doing so with humor, which I think you do in almost all of your projects, and you do it so well. I just wondered if you have anything to speak to for that.
Thank you. I don't know if I have any specific advice with regards to that. I would just say, just don't go for the easy stereotype. Don't go for the easy story. And everything that you write, it's really tempting to just go down the route of, you know, the terrible tragedy with the broken family or the tall, dark stranger or whatever. And something beyond that is always just a little bit more interesting. And that includes humor. You know, the best source of dark humor is the emergency services. They see more bleak things than any of us ever do in our everyday lives, and yet they leaven it with humor, and that's how they get by. So yeah, I guess look around you at how people really respond to things rather than how you imagine they would respond to things. Does that make any sense?
It does, but I have another question then. So if you're sort of trying not to succumb to the cliche, do you ever find it hard to find the right path and the right thing? Do you ever go through periods where you just aren't writing because it's...
Yeah, the book I'm writing at the moment, I have started and deleted... Oh, gosh, I've written about 30,000 words. I've deleted about 60,000 words in the last 7 months because I just had to get it right. And so I guess that would be the other message to your readers, is just be ruthless with yourself. Don't go for the easy thing. Go for the thing that in your heart... you know is right, and you will know if it's not right because it's like a sore tooth. You know, your tongue can't leave it alone. Every time you read over it, it just doesn't quite fill you with joy. Well, you know what? Keep going until you write the thing that fills you with joy.
Okay, that's great advice. Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you for having me. I loved it.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with JoJo Moyes. You can learn more about her work at her website, jojomoyes.com. My second interview from the archives is with the author Heath Hardage Lee about her book, Winnie Davis, Daughter of the Lost Cause, published by Potomac Books. Heath Hardage Lee comes from a museum education, preservation, and program background. She holds a BA in history with honors from Davidson College and an MA in French language and literature from the University of Virginia. Heath is an independent historian, biographer, and curator. Potomac Books, a division of the University of Nebraska Press, published her prize-winning book, which we discuss in this interview, Winnie Davis, Daughter of the Lost Cause. Heath's narrative nonfiction book, entitled The League of Wives, The Untold Story of the Women Who Took on the U.S. Government to Bring Their Husbands Home from Vietnam, was published by St. Martin's Press in 2019. Actress Reese Witherspoon and her production company Hello Sunshine, in partnership with Sony 3000, have optioned The League of Wives, for a feature film. Heath Hartage Lee is an executive producer and historical consultant for the project. Winnie Davis, daughter of the Lost Cause, concerns Verena Ann Winnie Davis, born into a war-torn South in June of 1864, the youngest daughter of Confederate President Jefferson Davis and his second wife, Verena Howell Davis. Born only a month after the death of beloved Confederate hero General J.E.B. Stuart during a string of Confederate victories, Winnie's birth was hailed as a blessing by war-weary Southerners. They felt her arrival was a good omen, signifying future victory. But after the Confederacy's ultimate defeat in the Civil War, Winnie would spend her early life as a genteel refugee and a European expatriate abroad. After returning to the South from German boarding school, Winnie was christened the daughter of the Confederacy in 1886. This role was bestowed upon her by a Southern culture trying to sublimate its war losses. Particularly idealized by Confederate veterans and the United Daughters of the Confederacy, Winnie became an icon of the Lost Cause, eclipsing even her father Jefferson in popularity. When I spoke with Heath Hartage Lee, I began by asking her how Winnie came to be such a symbol of hope to the Confederacy.
It's interesting, the timing of her birth, which is just a few weeks after General Jeb Stuart dies. And he is a young, popular, dashing Confederate general. He's known for this plumed hat he wears. He's very dashing and very well dressed, even in battle. So he is killed, he sustains wounds from the Battle of Yellow Tavern, which is north of Richmond. And the whole Confederacy is plunged into mourning for this young general. He's 31 when he dies. So they're at a very low point in terms of morale. And then a few weeks later, Winnie is born at the White House of the Confederacy in Richmond, which comes to be seen almost as sort of a shrine to the Confederacy and later to the Lost Cause. So Confederates tend to be very, and Southerners even today, I'm the same way, are very superstitious. So they see this as a good omen, perhaps signifying that the tide of battle will turn and that some hope is restored to this effort. So it's an interesting connection, and Jeb Stuart IV has been a family friend growing up, so we had a great time kind of exploring these connections, and he wrote a foreword to the book that talks a little about this.
Right, and he would be the great-grandson of the person you were just talking about who died, right?
Okay. Yes.
Yeah, all right.
That's right.
Now, you and Winnie Davis are both from Richmond, and this is just one of many similarities between the two of you. I enjoyed reading some of those. I presume this is one reason you were so interested in studying her and writing about her. I wondered if that was the case.
Oh, absolutely. And the preface talks a little bit about that. I grew up in Richmond, kind of a similar background. I knew so many of these Confederate descendants and people in different kind of Southern history groups. And then when you live in Richmond, you're surrounded by evidence of the war all the time. Mm-hmm. Earthen works that are still there, people turn up artifacts just constantly, even today. So it just was sort of all around me, and you sort of grow up with that in your blood. And when I saw that picture, the portrait of her, the portrait on the cover of the book is actually a different portrait that I had also seen, but the original portrait I saw was very similar. It was this beautiful woman with this melancholy expression on her face, and I just kept, I wondered about her, and all the ladies at my mom's bridge club were like, oh, honey, that's Winnie Davis. Let us tell you about her. So it's sort of one of those stories that everybody kind of knew, but as I researched it, there were just so many errors and so many sort of myths about her, and it just made me want to learn more and to figure out what the real story was.
Now, so your mother's generation knew at least some truth about her or some story about her. Do you think that's still true for your generation? Do you think most women of your generation in Richmond know about Winnie Davis?
That is an excellent question. I would say absolutely not. They have no idea. I have many of my friends, and I'm 44, so that just to give you an age marker. I mean, they have no idea about this. She's really been kind of lost to the winds of time. And I do think a lot of younger people, they just don't seem to be quite as interested in history as maybe previous generations, which I hope will change. And I do think that's slowly changing. But yes, nobody knew who she was. And even members of my mother's generation, many of them didn't know, because she's a woman, she's somewhat obscure.
And so much of her correspondence has disappeared.
Yeah.
So probably burned by her mother, Verena. So it was fun to have this burst on the scene. And people in Richmond have been, I mean, it's been, all the audiences for talks have been packed. People are really interested in learning about her.
Oh, that's fantastic.
A good sign.
Yeah, you know, it's so sad to lose the history instead of just maybe losing the tension that existed around this family and the sadness of the lost cause. You know, you kind of want to lose that tension, have the reconciliation be a real thing now, but keep the history, right?
Exactly. You would think 150 years later we could look at it and learn some lessons from it instead of being so partisan about it.
Yeah. Although it's funny, reading your book, it made me understand the divisions that still exist. You know, I mean, the South and the North were horrible to each other.
They were.
Just horrible. I mean, I knew that. But reading some of this was really an eye-opener.
It is pretty horrifying what went on. And you can understand in any conquered sort of nation or people, there's so much resentment that really never goes away. And, you know, homes were burned. The whole economy was destroyed. I mean, it was, you know, there was a lot of pillaging going on. So it's understandable why people are still upset. And still we have terms that persist, like Yankee or, you know, these derogatory terms, because people are still angry about it. You know, but even the younger people here still kind of retain a little bit of that, though I think it's more tongue-in-cheek now. But it's understandable.
I do want to just mention one thing that you just said. I want to talk about one thing that you just said, and that is that probably her mother burned her letters.
Yeah.
And that was really interesting to me. You write in the book about how a young lady's letters would later be burned to preserve her, I don't know, her virtue, her personal life.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Oh, yes. I mean, this is regular practice in the 19th century for, you know, husbands would burn their wives' letters. In this case, Winnie's mother, we can't be 100% sure, but pretty close, that her mother burned probably her love letters, if any existed, which I'm sure they did, between Fred and Winnie. Any correspondence between them, with a few exceptions, was burned. And it was considered, you know, you should really only be in the paper, that old saying, you know, when you die, get married, you know, or born, that's it. And and even less so in the 19th century, you really shouldn't be in the paper at all.
Right.
And the Davis family was constantly in the news. They were celebrities. So, you know, they really did this in the 19th century to protect privacy. And it was also because women's correspondence was not seen as important. They were not seen as public or political figures generally, so it wasn't deemed important to preserve these papers. So that's typical.
So it's not more sinister, you know. I almost felt like they were expunging any evidence that she had a brain or a heart.
Yes. right. And she was, so, you know, and her mother, on certain things you would find things she had kept, you know, references to how learned she was, how educated she was, or artistic, that was okay. But anything about her love life or the scandal of being engaged to a northerner with an abolitionist grandfather, it's gone.
Yeah.
So I do think Verena did some editing, for sure.
Yeah.
I'm not sure it wasn't as sinister as it looks, just because this was regular practice at the time.
Yes.
Okay. But she definitely was picking and choosing what she got rid of.
And I do want to talk about her engagement, but we'll get to that. But so I also wanted to just talk a little bit about the family. You know, when Winnie was still little, the family experienced so much loss, and then afterwards continued to. They had children die from diseases, and there was a terrible accident. Jefferson Davis himself lost a wife before he even met Verena. Mm-hmm. So was this just the times, or were they more unfortunate than most?
And that is also an excellent question. People say, they always say, oh, well, you know, in the Civil War times and before, I mean, obviously you didn't have antibiotics. So there was a lot of death. And I say in the book that death kind of lurked around every nursery corner. And that is true. However, I do think the Davises suffered a disproportionate amount of loss compared to most people of the time. And I did some comparisons, just, you know, sort of anecdotal, but also just kind of looking across the board at some statistics. And I do think it was more than the usual. Now, you can look at Lincoln's family, for instance, and they lost those sons as well. So there are a lot of parallels between those two families. Mm-hmm. But in addition, Jefferson's, as you mentioned, his first wife, Sarah Knox Taylor, Zachary Taylor's daughter, they were married for 3 months, and she died of malaria. So this sort of sets him up. He's already emotionally developing kind of a protective shell. And then all four boys eventually dies. The Davises have 6 children. All 4 of them die, one from the accident, others from disease. And then, you know, Winnie dies young. So
yeah,
this is disproportionate. And then you add to this the losses of the Civil War, the loss of fortune, the loss of land, the loss of reputation.
Mm-hmm.
This is crushing. So it's almost like a Greek tragedy. It's way out of proportion to what most people experienced at the time.
Yeah. I was really surprised to read about the Davis family's reaction to Lincoln's death, and actually the Confederate reaction, but I don't know that I can generalize that way. But the Davis family in particular both worried that this would point to them as conspirators, but also they were very worried that this would increase division between North and South.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the war, and as a push toward reconciliation was just about to begin. And I was touched to see their grief about Lincoln's assassination, actually.
Yeah. And that was true in the whole, you know, Burton Harrison, the others in the Confederate cabinet, they were all shocked and saddened. This was not what they wanted. And after the war, there's a lot of documentation about Jefferson Davis really wanting reconciliation. He did not want the Confederate presidency to begin with. So, and Verena from the beginning prophesied that this would be a failure. So they knew that this was not going to end well, but they wanted to do, I think they felt, as many did, like Robert E. Lee, that it was their duty to be on this side for various reasons. But they were all just completely shocked when Lincoln was assassinated, and horrified when the Northern press was trying to pin the murder, the assassination of Lincoln, on Davis. So this was not something they ever would have wished for.
Yeah, just amazing. Mm-hmm. Now, you just mentioned Robert E. Lee. I have to ask, are you related to Robert E. Lee, your last name?
Oh,
being
my
Lee?
Gosh. This is a funny story. So, yeah, I mean, distantly, yes. And I worked for Stratford Hall, Robert E. Lee's boyhood home, for a number of years in fundraising, and we would always laugh about it. Of course, I could never quite figure out the descent, but we'd always say, oh, I should just say I'm his granddaughter, great-granddaughter, or something. So that would really have enhanced my ability to help Stratford Hall, but it's a very distant and somewhat tenuous relationship on my husband's side.
Okay.
So. I think Robert E. Lee is super cool, but that's tenuous.
Okay, all right. This is a quote from the book that I thought really summed up a lot of what you were writing about at the end of the war and after the war. Utter desolation of the spirit remained in Southern communities long after the military conflict had ceased. Mm-hmm. That just really struck me reading this book. And part of what made me so sad was to read about the way Jefferson Davis's reputation was attacked in the media. They accused him of trying to flee in a woman's dress, and they wrote very unkindly about the fact that Verena threw herself in between Jefferson Davis and a Union soldier who had a gun trained on him. Mm-hmm. and said he wasn't a real man, and that she, you know, basically essentially wore the pants in the family.
Yes.
So sad. Just, you know, I mean, I suppose that's not the worst thing that, I mean, certainly we see that in the media today, but can you just talk about this and what this did to him?
Oh, absolutely. And this is really kind of a crucial point in the story, too. There's a lot about some research that's been done, and more that I did, about Southern manhood in relation to the war. So calling Jefferson Davis, saying that he escaped in petticoats, which was the rumor in the Northern press. I mean, more than a rumor, they printed all kinds of cartoons and caricatures of Davis escaping in petticoats. And this was just a blow at the heart and the manhood of not just Davis, but the whole Confederacy. And then Verena, you know, her involvement also, it just was used to say, you know, Verena Davis threw herself in between her husband and federal troops, she wears the pants in the family. Davis is a coward, and he's effeminate. So this was just a huge insult in the 19th century. And Winnie, her significance in relation to this is she is used to prove Davis's virility and his manhood. He had children, he was married, so he was not effeminate. And this all sounds just ridiculous to us in the time that we live in, but at the time, this was really important to understand that she, even as a child and a baby, was used as evidence that he was a man, he was not a coward, and that it sort of also gave the Confederacy back its virility and its manhood. So she was very symbolic, and that whole episode is kind of when Winnie starts becoming the daughter of the Confederacy, even that early. She is helping her father rehabilitate his reputation.
Yeah. She grew into that role very gracefully, it sounds like, at least at first.
Yeah. She did. She was, you know, I really think she was okay with it, if a bit bewildered by it. I'm sure read in the book, so in 1886, she and her father have this fateful train trip to dedicate Confederate monuments across the South, and she is pulled out of the train by General John B. Gordon, who's a former Confederate general, kind of a military hero. He's a politician running for office, and he pulls her out of the train and says, "I present to you the daughter of the Confederacy." She is not required to say anything. She is just Jefferson Davis's daughter. She has the pedigree. She's young and beautiful, and she's a symbol. So I think she's okay in the early days, even though she really doesn't understand it because she's been to German boarding school for a number of years and is essentially German, playing an American, Southern American role that she doesn't understand. But it begins to dawn on her later that this could be a problem.
I enjoyed reading that one of the reasons they sent her to boarding school, but maybe specifically to Germany, is that her father was concerned about her basically not doing as she was told and being very headstrong and sort of being a teenager and talking back,
being a teenager,
suspect.
Yes. Imagine doing that.
So she gets shipped off to Germany for 5 years.
Oh, poor thing. There's that picture in the book of her, of Winnie as a teenager with this very sullen expression on her face, right. And I'm like, well, A, she was a teenager. They all look like that. But you know, I would be mad too if I got shipped off to boarding school. Not in Paris either, like her sister, who was lucky. She was in Germany. It was Spartan. The water would freeze in the pitchers, that, you know, and overnight. They didn't always have what they should to eat.
Right.
She did learn a lot. She was, you know, became one of the most educated women of her time and fluent in French and German. But she did not, you know, she was super homesick, and she was sent there. One of the big reasons was to crush her independent spirit and to make her submissive, which, looking at both her parents, you think, oh my goodness, they're both so headstrong and so opinionated. It's interesting that they don't respect that virtue in others and don't want to cultivate it.
Right. But they had a troubled marriage, and it sounds like all of them were control freaks, right?
Oh, total control freaks. Absolutely.
You know.
Stage mom. Verena, I always compare, there's the show Dance Moms that my 12-year-old loves to watch about dance moms in Pittsburgh and the control they have over these young girls that are dancers. And it in a funny way kind of reminds me of Winnie and Verena, because Verena is a total stage mother. I have many letters where she's trying to control her career, her personal life, her movements in New York when she goes for a visit. Jefferson Davis, of the two of them, is less of a control freak. He's actually a lot more laid back about Winnie's life, adores her, but her mother is the one that really tries to control everything. So she has a rough time with that.
Yeah. Now, speaking of her mother's letters, reminds me of this quote that I loved. So Winnie was powerful and headstrong, and she was educated. She was not interested in what you refer to in the book as the modes of the day. And Verena either said or wrote this, I forget. Winnie does not care enough for dress, and when I have been urging her to rearrange some half-worn dress, she leads off on the woes of the Irish, the labor question, or some system of philosophy which she has been studying with intense interest.
That's true. I love that quote. You picked a great one.
I feel like the whole boarding school thing sort of backfired on them.
Totally backfired. So yes, she's submissive, but now she is a blue stocking. You know, as they would later say, she's very intellectual and very, now she's totally anti all the modes, the fashion, and she never was into clothes or dressing up. Verena did like that, and Winnie would have none of it. So they perhaps the cure in Germany worked too well, too serious when she came back.
Yeah.
And that made it hard to fit in with her peers. As you can see in the book, she feels like a stranger in a strange land when she comes back, because she's essentially German. Her English is not very good. She knows nothing of American history. Her parents have deliberately kept this from her, yet she comes to represent the Lost Cause, the Confederacy, the whole secession movement. So it's
right.
Very ironic. She's an interesting choice to play the daughter of the Confederacy.
Yeah, although perhaps that was part of what set her off on this feeling like an outsider. I mean, nobody mm-hmm. who's held up on a pedestal feels like part of the group, really.
Exactly. Right. And it did encourage resentment, you know, other daughters of other generals. For instance, Robert E. Lee, who we talked about, you know, he is this very famous general and really much better liked than Jefferson Davis, but his daughters never receive the amount of adulation that Winnie does, nor does her sister Margaret.
Mm-hmm.
So she has something. She has a quality, this charisma. Without even speaking, she just has that it, kind of like Clara Bow when they call her the it girl. It's the same thing with Winnie. She's got something that people are attracted to.
Yeah, yeah. Moving on in time, she traveled to Syracuse. She traveled a lot. It's sort of representing the mm-hmm. South and trying to find a role for herself. And one of the things that she did was she traveled to Syracuse to visit a prominent family that had invited her for some sort of party or gathering. And she met and fell in love with Alfred Wilkinson, who was a Northern lawyer. And his grandfather had been a famous abolitionist.
Yeah.
Which is a wonderful part of her life. So this surprised and scandalized her friends and Southern groups who idolized her. But I was shocked at how her family was surprisingly supportive after meeting him. And I wondered if you could talk about that. And maybe that goes to what you were saying about Jefferson Davis being a little more laid back than we might have expected.
Yes, surprising, really shocking. And, you know, when I went to do the research for this book, I think everybody going in has misconceptions and stereotypes and things that we've had in our head forever. And one of the things that I had was that Jefferson Davis was the one that forbade this match between the
yeah.
Yankee and the daughter of the Confederacy. And this is not true at all. And this was only found out after I read a bunch of letters, because official history, particularly of the 30s and the 40s, says that he said, "I will never consent. This is not happening." And he really liked Fred. He was the one, he invited him when Fred came to Beauvoir to ask for Winnie's hand. And Jefferson Davis immediately likes him, invites him to go to see the flounders, the fish at the beach, and invites him back. And they just totally hit it off. Now, Verena likes Fred at first, too. She describes, you know, how handsome he is and what a good heart he has. But he has good teeth, which is always really important. So, you know, she's like totally, she's digging Fred, too. So this is all good. But it's so ironic to me that they really don't do any background research at all into who this person is until things turn, until other people start saying things. So it is surprising. Davis is very laid back, and even throughout the whole engagement, he wants Winnie to be happy. I think that really was his primary goal.
Yeah.
Verena has mixed motives, which you see later in the book about
right.
the whole thing.
Right, right. Yeah, and the funny thing is that the person who ultimately seems like she sort of swamps the whole affair is Winnie herself. She
mm-hmm.
she starts to have mixed feelings. Now, it sounds like she was quite often ill, like
mm-hmm.
she was physically ill with things like gastritis, but possibly also depressed. Is that?
Oh yes,
yeah.
I think so. And I had a question. I was at Gettysburg speaking Sunday. And I had a question about depression in the Davis family. And this, again, is my sort of amateur psychology research. But I think that Jefferson Davis and Winnie both had inherent depression. I think they had inherent anxiety and depression issues. They both had sort of anorexic tendencies. They wouldn't eat. They were highly nervous. Now, Winnie, I'm not sure, as a little girl was like that, but after Germany, she sort of developed this very nervous, sickly temperament, and both of them had constant stomach problems, eye problems. Verena, on the other hand, I think had more of a reactive depression because she had lost all her boys. She had suffered the defeat of war, no money, et cetera, and so she had depressive episodes, but I think hers was more in reaction as opposed to inherent, because she was inherently a very strong person. So it's interesting to look at these patterns in the family. So, but Winnie, for sure, she had her dad's nervous temperament and was constantly ill and would use it to get out of things like parties or public appearances. Not all the time, but she definitely bailed on things using the excuse that she was ill with gastritis all the time.
You know, as far as Verena goes, I also think it must have been a really hard thing for her that Jefferson Davis was so in love with his first wife, who was this young, beautiful, you know, new love to him, and probably never had the opportunity to get on his nerves, let alone get unattractive, because she died at, like, what, like 22 or something?
Yeah, she was like 19. We all look good at 19.
I know,
you know,
right?
Come on. So, oh, totally. Yes, oh, and Verena called her the Sainted Sarah. You probably saw in the book. I mean, she got very tired of that. Yes, and Sarah, they were married 3 months. Nobody had time to pick up dirty socks off the floor, do dishes. I mean, it was just no time for that. So she was this idealized ghost, and she really haunted the marriage from the beginning. On the honeymoon, Jefferson insisted they go visit Sarah's grave, which that wouldn't make me feel really great about my marriage starting out if I had to go visit the first wife's grave. So there was a pall over the marriage from the start. And Verena, there's a wonderful article, I think it's Carol Blazer, who wrote it about Verena advising a young girl later it was something about the gnarled tree and the oak tree. Don't take half of someone. Don't take an old tree and take just a bit of it. You want the whole thing, the young relationship. You don't want to be second best. So she really felt that way. And Jefferson's writings, like when he writes about her towards the end of his life, he barely mentions her in his recollections.
He says she bore me 6 children. That's it. And he didn't even say her name. I was pretty tired of him by the end of this book.
I have to say I liked him on some fronts better, but on marriage, he really, I mean, I think he would have been impossible. And Verena was not easy either. I mean, she was very opinionated, very much of our time. She would have fit in great right now, but she had to put up with a lot. And he was a typical 19th century aristocratic white male of the time. This was what they expected. So he wasn't horrible. And, you know, if you looked at his peers, this is very typical of what they expect. But he was very, even his generals, you'll always read about what a micromanager he was, and he was not great at personal relationships. So poor Verena, I think it was quite an epic battle between them for dominance all the time. And Winnie surely saw this.
Yeah. I wanted to talk a little bit about Winnie as having been a talented writer. She was a very talented writer, and I'm wondering if you could talk about how this affected her life.
Yes, I think my conclusion about Winnie's life, I think what she really wanted to do from the time she was very young, probably a young teenager, was to be a writer. She was always writing things. She was always very curious about the world, what was going on around her. And I think marriage and a domestic life, while she maybe could have been convinced into that, that wasn't her primary goal in life. She really wanted to be an author, and she did it, which in that time in the 19th century, this is really unusual, particularly for the daughter of the Confederacy with all these obstacles and pressures to represent the daughter, the Confederacy in the Lost Cause, which she continues to do throughout her life. She also wrote 2 novels. She actually had 3. She had one that was published privately about Serpent Myths. It was more of a long article. And then she had The Veiled Doctor and A Romance of Summer Seas, which are kind of typical melodramatic Victorian novels. But to publish them with a New York publisher, just like today, that's a big deal. And it brought in significant income for Verena and Winnie, who needed it. They were sort of doing that. They had moved to New York after Winnie and Fred broke up, and then Winnie becomes a writer, as does Verena, for Joseph Pulitzer at the World newspaper. So they mm-hmm. have that money coming in from that, and then Winnie's writing her books. So they're career women, they're self-supporting, they're living this wonderful intellectual life in New York. And I love that Winnie fulfilled that dream and did that in a time where this was just not done by particularly upper-class women. This was really almost scandalous that you would do this, but they needed the money. They really didn't have the financial means to just float around and go to parties, nor did right. they have the inclination to do that.
Now, do you think that she was influenced by the families and mostly her father's association with Sarah Dorsey, who was also this authoress, you say in the book?
I love that's what I want to be when I grow up,
an authoress.
I just love how that sounds. I always threaten in my family that I'm going to be the authoress, and they all start, you know, pretending to vomit. So I don't think that'll work now, but I do, and I think Sarah Dorsey is totally fascinating, and the whole relationship with Dorsey and Davis, very interesting. I don't think, though, that Sarah Dorsey had a huge influence on Winnie, because they never really met.
No, they didn't. I wasn't sure. Okay.
And I should make that clear in the book. Though Sarah Dorsey, Beauvoir is given eventually to Jefferson Davis, and when he dies, Sarah Dorsey fixes it so Winnie gets it, not Verena.
Right.
Verena and Sarah Dorsey have a very fraught relationship. So Winnie gets not only Beauvoir, which she does inherit eventually, Sarah Dorsey's portrait goes to Winnie, though neither of them have met. So she may be surely Winnie would have read some of her work. She knew about her, but I never ran across anything noting any influence or saying much about that. I think she was influenced a lot by her mother, who was a voracious reader and loved artists and intellectuals her entire life. I think one of the highlights of Verena's life is when Oscar Wilde comes to Beauvoir to visit, mm-hmm. which that would be the highlight of my life, too. That would be super, super cool. And Jefferson Davis just thought he was an idiot, of course, but Verena was very enchanted with Oscar Wilde. And both parents were big readers, and to give them credit, full proponents of Winnie, learning things, reciting Shakespeare, learning about authors and writing. So they thought that was fine. And she was surrounded by, you know, very bright intellectual people.
Yeah.
Sarah Dorsey, I think, might have been a background influence, but maybe not a direct one on her writing.
So most of their association with her one-on-one was when Winnie was in Germany, is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay.
That's right. And then Sarah Dorsey dies of breast cancer before she and Winnie ever meet. So she's more of a financial beneficiary and an ardent supporter of Jefferson Davis while he writes his memoir, and that is while Winnie is in Germany. So she kind of misses big pieces of that, really misses meeting Sarah Dorsey at all.
Yeah, okay. Now, you have essentially been working on this book for over 20 years. I loved reading this fact because I feel like, you know, we read about the Stephen Kings and we read about these, you know, authors that really are publishing something every year, and good for them. And I'm not saying that that's anything to sneeze at. I'm sure that's hard work too. But I feel like there are a lot of authors who spend a lot of time on their works, and you know, then 20 years later, you have created this perfect little gem. So I wondered if you can talk about that.
Oh, well, that one is such a compliment. I really appreciate that. It, you know, 20 years. I guess I started on this when I was 21, and I'm 44 now, and it became my thesis in college. I was Southern women's history major, essentially, so it caught my interest, and I worked in museums my whole career, and I think many of us find, particularly writers, you've got to keep your day job. It's not the most lucrative profession in the
sure.
world, and I loved museums, and that was kind of my passion, was history museums, so I was always working, picking up bits and pieces, finding out more, and there was so much scattered to the winds because of so much of her Winnie's correspondence being burned. So it took a long time to piece this together and had to go peripherally and look at papers of those who surrounded her to find things. So It took a long time because of that, because of working, and I had two children. So life really got in the way, but the story had such a strong hold. I was like, I've got to do this. I've got to do it. And then we were unexpectedly moved to Des Moines, Iowa for my husband's job in 2009. And then I thought, okay, I have no excuse now. I think Winnie is making me move to Iowa so that I will focus on her because it was so hard here in Richmond. There's so much, I'm from here, and there was just too much going on in other ways. And I also think it was really hard to write about her living in Richmond. You're sort of so much a part of it, it's really hard to separate from it. Mm-hmm. And I was worried too much, I think, about what people might think. Would I offend people? And then I moved to Iowa and I thought, I don't care. I'm anonymous. I can do whatever I want. And I had a perspective on it also being an outsider. Like Winnie, I had to move away to really get into the subject and emotionally connect with it. So, I think also being older, having experienced some sad things in my own life, it made it more relatable. And I don't think as a 25-year-old even or a 30-year-old, I don't think I had the empathy to relate to some of these things like the deaths of children or the loss of fortune or any of that. It just, it wasn't as, I guess I wasn't emotionally connecting with it as much. But you get a little older and everybody has things happen, and I just could so relate to these people.
So it
took a while, but I think sometimes it's better, you know, to be a little more mature when you write a story like that.
I want to clarify something I just said, too. I said that it's the perfect little gem, and I didn't mean the little to trivialize it. I'm literally saying, because the book is about 200 pages, and to work on something for 20 years and be able to keep it taut and just not spare in a bad way, just like really readable and not this huge thing that got out of control and isn't filled with every little fact you came across. I think that in itself is a real talent.
Well, that also, huge compliment. And I have to thank my editor, Bridget Berry, because she helped me so much to pare down. And so much of, you know, I think when you have these big books with every little fact, it kind of shows sometimes a lack of confidence that you have to quote five sources to support one thing. And one thing Bridget taught me is you are the world Winnie expert. You know what you're talking about. So you don't need to cite 15 people to support a thought that you have. And that was a real learning process for me, because I really, at first, I think we had a lot more when we started the editing process, and a lot ended up on the cutting room floor because it was just saying the same thing that was obvious. So that is a talent I think I'm always learning, and I think a good editor is huge in that process. And so many writers don't have that anymore with all the budget cuts and just the way the publishing industry is going. So I have to thank University of Nebraska Press and Bridget Berry. She is a superstar. And also Elizabeth Gratch, my copy editor, who is just elegant in the way she helped me structure things.
Now, one thing that I was excited about on your behalf as I read about it, apparently one of Winnie's journals turned up in 2010 at an auction somewhere. And I thought, oh my goodness, if you were working on this for 20 some years, 2010 is 4 years ago, that must have changed a lot for you as far as your research went, did it? Or
definitely. Oh my gosh. Well, two fortuitous things. And this is where being a superstitious Southerner, it is too perfect the way this turned out. So yes, in 2010, this Italian diary of Winnie's came up for auction. And this is when Winnie and Fred go to Italy on this trip, basically unchaperoned with Joseph and Kate Pulitzer.
Oh, her mother would have burned that one.
They are the worst. I have a slide that I find amusing. I think other people do, about Joseph and Kate being the worst chaperones of all time, which they really were. Joseph Pulitzer was the newspaper baron, and he was married to Kate Davis, who is a cousin, distant cousin, of Jefferson Davis, and they became great friends with Winnie and agreed to chaperone a trip with Winnie, and Fred later came over, and they traveled throughout Europe and mostly in Italy. So Joseph was practically blind at this point, and Kate would soon start an affair with one of Pulitzer's colleagues at the newspaper. So they really weren't watching. Winnie and Fred could have done whatever they wanted to do. And this diary details many of their outings unchaperoned in the carriage to go see Mount Vesuvius or to go see different points of interest in Italy. And it's pretty shocking in the 19th century that this would ever happen. There's, you know, some great books, one called Love Fiercely by Jean Zimmerman that I used to kind of learn about Victorian dating customs. And this was just never done. And I still can't believe the Davises let Winnie and Fred go on this trip unchaperoned with really pretty poor chaperones. So so that diary, yes, to answer that in a roundabout way, it was quite a find. Now, it is very subdued because it is dedicated to Verena Davis. So I know Winnie did a lot of self-editing when she wrote these passages, but you can read between the lines a lot, and there's a lot in there about how Winnie views relationships, and she's very negative about marriage relationships. And it just, you really had to read through it and read between the lines, but I gleaned a ton from that about how she viewed her relationship with Fred. The other document that came up, too, was the memoir from Fred's family. Now, Fred Wilkinson was related to the Alcott family, and the family members, current-day family members, Eve LaPlante, who is also a wonderful author. She writes a lot about Louisa and her mother. She has two great books out right now about the family. She contacted me, saw an article about Winnie, and said, I have a memoir from Fred's family that talks about the engagement and the Wilkinson's view of it. Would you like to see it? And I about jumped out of my skin. I really freaked out. This is what historians like. I was like, oh my God, this is like a movie. This is unbelievable. I will get on a plane to Boston right now and go see it. And she very kindly Xeroxed it for me or copied it for me and sent it to me. That was huge because the Wilkinson family felt Verena had ruined the match, which she had. So it kind of corroborated some hunches that I had, and I was just so lucky. This is luck, or maybe things were falling into place for a reason, who knows, but really thrilling for any historian to have these things just fall in your lap, essentially.
Oh, yeah, that's so great. Okay, so we're kind of winding down on our time. I want to just ask you two really quick questions.
Sure.
First of all, I'm wondering, do you miss working on this project after so much time? Are you missing it, or are you still so busy with it that you don't have that space yet?
Well, you know, that's a great question. When I first finished the manuscript, it was really like having postpartum depression. And a lot of biographers, I think, go through this. I've lived with her so long, and you know, I still felt like there were pieces that I didn't know, and you know, it was really hard to let it go, particularly when you go into the editing process. That was really hard for a couple of months. And now I'm kind of in the throes. I'm doing talks all over the country. I've had a lot of interest, a lot of filming, of TV stuff, and I mean, people seem very interested in it. So I am thoroughly enjoying the speaking part and telling it as a story to people so that they really get it with the pictures and my PowerPoint slides. You can really see this person and get to know her. So I feel like I'm still living with her and still telling her story. But I think when the book tour is over, which won't really be till 2015, then I'm going to really be sad. I just am not sure I'm ever going to find a story as fascinating as Winnie. She's kind of a once-in-a-lifetime.
Now, would you ever consider working on it in another form, like historical fiction or anything? Or
I've been through that, and I've had, it was funny, when I first started pitching this to agents and publishers, they all wanted it to be fiction. And I kind of went back and forth, but you know, I started out doing a lot of journalism and reporting, and I really feel like I am a nonfiction writer, and I think that the truth is almost always stranger than fiction. So I'll never say never, but I really think I would probably will always stick with a nonfiction book format. I am somewhat interested in doing a young adult version of Winnie because I think there's so many themes of parental approval, of forbidden love, of things that young adults would really relate to, but I would also want to do that in a nonfiction form, and I have had some interest in that. So Winnie may not be completely going away.
Okay.
She may live on in the young adult
world. Well,
that's
good since we just got her.
So. Right. I know. We need her to stick around. And I think other historians can. I have a young friend, Zaris Martinez, at Chapel Hill doing her PhD on Winnie. And we've met recently, and I would love her to write another book about Winnie, to keep adding to the scholarship, because there are pieces like that come up at auction, things that may come up later that could really add to her. So I think she definitely deserves more than one book.
Yeah. So my last question for you, Heath, is can you name a few of your favorite books or maybe authors who've had an impact on you?
Oh, this is such a fun question. I love that question because there's so many of them. And I always thought about that when I was reading. And of course, when you are trying to sell the book, you have to come up with sort of comparative literature. So, and I am a huge voracious reader. So the book that there were a couple of books that influenced me a lot during the writing of the book. One is called The Women Jefferson Loved by Virginia Scharf, which was about really the psychology of the women around Thomas Jefferson, Sally Hemings, his daughter, his wife, and so much of it, like mine, she was working with narrative black holes where there wasn't a lot of archival evidence or letters or diaries. And she did such an elegant job of making psychological suppositions and supporting it as best she could with other sources. Mm-hmm. So that was a huge influence. Amanda Foreman's book, Georgiana, the Duchess of Devonshire, is one of my favorite books ever. The same thing, you had a woman who was in and of herself was very important as a political figure, but had been forgotten by time, and she just brought her to life so beautifully. Eric Larson, also in The Garden of Beasts, about Hitler, fabulous. I mean, you felt like you were there, and he used the ambassador, the U.S. ambassador who was from Chicago, who was sort of a minor player, but had this window to see everything. And then the last one that was really a big influence, which may seem a little strange, but The Hare with the Amber Eyes by Edmund de Waal, that is about the Rothschild family. Uh-huh. It was the most elegant biography/memoir I have ever read. It was also very spare, but it was so beautiful. Like every word was just chosen with such care. And he himself is a very well-known ceramic artist. So he had this artful eye that I always try to remember that, to weave in the art and the art history of the time, the interiors and the clothes. And he did such a beautiful job of that. So those were sort of my primary books, and there were others. I've mentioned Jean Zimmerman's book, Love Fiercely, which was about the Victorian age, and that was wonderful. So there's so many good books, but those were probably the main ones.
All right. So I want to thank you so much for speaking with me today. I'll just say again, the name of the book is Winnie Davis, Daughter of the Lost Cause, published by Potomac Books, which is part of University of Nebraska Press. So Heath Hartage Lee, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
That once again was a conversation with Heath Hartage Lee. You can learn more about her work at heathleeauthor.com. I should mention that one of the favorite authors that Heath brought up during the interview was my guest on Write the Book a number of years ago. You can find my conversation with Jean Zimmerman about her novel, The Orphan Master, published by Viking, at my podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. Today's Write the Book prompt is to consider this sentence and either start with it or let it inform your work. She had only been a crossing guard for 2 days. Good luck with your work in the coming week. And please tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. A reminder to listeners who write, I do share a writing prompt each week, so be sure to check the archives of Write the Book if you'd like to find any that you might have missed. Usually they're suggested by my guests, but sometimes I come up with one. I would love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We're also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and lots of other podcast sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you like the show, please do rate it where you find it, like it on social media, talk about it, tell your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM. WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3 WBTV.org. Stay well and have a great week.